From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, last week, the Central Valley took center stage in American politics with Kevin McCarthy's ascent to the position of House Majority Leader. Political junkie Ken Rudin will join us to explain how the Bakersfield Republican has risen so quickly to power and what it means for the GOP and for the Central Valley. We'll also take a trip down what some have called the most endangered river in the U.S., the San Joaquin, with John D. Sutter of CNN. We'll catch up with him in Merced County in the middle of his quest to kayak from Friant Dam near Fresno to San Francisco Bay. And we'll get a preview of an event that seeks to celebrate the Valley's software development community, the 59 Days of Code. It's like Shark Tank, but here in the Valley and for local programmers. But first, the second in our series of special reports on groundwater here in Central California. Californians across the state are becoming more reliant on underground water during the drought. But policymakers and environmental groups agree better management of the resource is needed. In today's report, Pauline Bartolone looks into efforts to manage groundwater more sustainably here in the Valley.
Vic Bruno's home isn't connected to a public water system. Like most rural homeowners in Madera County, his water comes from a deep hole in the ground.
I believe it's a 3/4-inch pipe that goes all the way down 300 feet.
Bruno has lived here for 25 years. His ranch is also home to a whole gang of farm animals. So when his well started pumping up sand, he thought of them.
I've got horses, sheep, pigs. These guys need water.
Bruno has water for now, but he's at the bottom of his well. He's been told he'll have to drill deeper.
I don't think anybody's prepared to pay $16,000 to $30,000 out of their income. I'm 61 years old. I have my finances set for retirement, not for this.
He's convinced that the nut tree farmers just down the road are to blame, but that's hard to say. Central Valley Regional Water Regulators don't keep track of who is using how much well water, nor does the state.
We are seeing a doubling or more of permits, some related to persons out of water, but some related to new construction as well.
Wayne Fox is with the Environmental Health Division of Fresno County, just south of Madera. Local agencies, not the state, manage groundwater in California. But the extent of their monitoring and authority varies widely. Fox says Fresno County hasn't denied one well permit this year.
The fact that surface water isn't available to our west side farmers has caused a very large surge in those farmers drilling wells where they didn't have a well before.
And it really is kind of a free-for-all.
Laurel Firestone is with the Community Water Center.
Anyone that can afford to, you know, stick a straw into the ground and drill a well can pump close to as much as they need or want.
California state water managers say groundwater levels have been at all-time lows in most areas of the state since 2008, especially in the San Joaquin Valley. Firestone says it's hard to manage a resource when governments don't have basic information.
One of the components of starting to manage groundwater sustainably is ensuring that we have adequate data, that we have data on where wells are and how they're being used, how much water is being pumped.
She says local agencies don't have clear powers over groundwater use, but that's something the Brown administration is hoping to change this year. California Department of Food and Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross says a number of agencies are working on a long-term sustainability plan.
It's very important that we not try to dictate one size fits all.
Ross says California's landscapes are so diverse, groundwater is best managed by local agencies. But in its plan, the state would be a backstop when, for example, there is no local political will.
Where we have severely impacted groundwater basins, the state is also signaling that we will step in to actually develop a plan until the locals are able to take that over themselves.
The State Water Board already has the power to intervene in cases of wasteful or unreasonable water use. That power has rarely been used in dealing with groundwater. California Farm Bureau President Paul Wenger says if policymakers aren't careful when creating new groundwater rules, the state's farmers could suffer something similar to the mortgage crisis.
And we have a lot of farmers trying to survive right now, and their survival is groundwater. And what they see is folks now want to come after their groundwater. It's called checkmate. You're done. You're finished. You're out of business.
Wenger says the best way to manage groundwater is to increase surface water supplies. He says that helps recharge what's underground. But Wenger says the only water option he hears is less.
If there's two people floating in the ocean, there's only one life ring to go out there, one of those people is going to think that they're more important than the other one. And that's exactly the discussion we have going on right now.
Two California bills calling for sustainable groundwater regulation are being considered in the legislature right now. It's too early to tell what kind of change will come or when. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A few months ago, a national group named the San Joaquin River as the nation's most endangered waterway. The drought has even made the story more dramatic. There's one journalist right now who is on a bit of an experiential journalism quest. He's kayaking the San Joaquin River from the base of Fryant Dam to San Francisco Bay. His name is John D. Sutter with CNN. He joins us now on the telephone from Merced County. John, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us where you're at right now and what's happening on your trip, which started on the 14th at the base of Fryant Dam.
So I'm in the Grasslands Ecological Region, I think in the state park right now. The lines sort of shift. But I'm at the part of the San Joaquin River just after it gets dry. I'm sure, you know, many of your listeners will realize that the San Joaquin does not, you know, make it to the sea. It doesn't make it to the Pacific Ocean. So I spent 3 days walking through a section of the river that was almost completely dry. And now I'm like kayaking in little spurts and then sort of dragging my boat across sections that are still relatively dry out here.
And along this journey, you're also talking to a lot of different people. You're talking to environmental advocates. You're talking to farmers. You're talking to local residents who live nearby the river. Take us through some of the people you've talked to, maybe first starting out at where the river is full of water and quite lush near Fryant Dam.
Yeah, no, my point in doing this is to try to meet everyone who depends on this river, and it seems like everyone does, regardless of how they, you know, how they think about it and how they speak of it. But yeah, I started up by Fryant Dam, where the river is, you know, very lively right now. There's a lot of water being released to certain farmers in the valley. And so, you know, it has some small white water. It's quick moving. It's ice cold. You know, it's just beautiful up there. I saw people fishing on Father's Day. I met several father-son pairs who were out on the water, you know, fishing. The first day, actually, I saw a wedding being set up on the banks of the river. I also saw a baptism occur in the river. So I've just been really surprised and happily amazed by how alive the river is, especially in that top section. You know, I came into this thinking like the San Joaquin is a dead river. It doesn't connect to the sea. It's disappearing. But one thing that I found, especially in the upper reaches near Fresno, is that, you know, people really do love this river and depend on it in ways that, you know, I found very surprising. And then so, you know, moving down from there, I met with a lot of farmers who obviously depend on the river for their livelihood, with farm workers who are sort of mystified by the state system of allotting water to some farms and, you know, none to others. I spent some time in a town with, you know, very high unemployment rates and, you know, and speaking to farm workers there. And then, you know, most recently I've been sort of on this slog through the stretch of the river that it's very sad to see, honestly, after seeing how majestic and beautiful the river is up top, to see, you know, where it dries out completely.
One of the things that continually amazes me living here in this area is how little the people who live in Central California, many of them at least, actually know about the San Joaquin River. You'll talk to some Fresno residents, they don't even know a river's there. You'll talk to some folks who don't really know where the water runs out. In fact, I probably couldn't tell you exactly where the water runs out. Can you describe that scene for us and what happens there when things begin to dry up, and where is that?
Yeah, so there's a structure called Sac Dam. You get past, so Fryant Dam is obviously the dam, you know, near Fresno. Then there's Mendota Pool, which I think of as like a switchboard for water. There are 20-some junctions there, you know, shuttling water both out of the river and into it. So most of the water that makes it past Mendota Pool actually isn't coming from the Sierra Mountains. It isn't coming from the San Joaquin River proper. It's being pumped in, you know, from Shasta Lake and then through the Delta and back up there. There's, you know, this incredible system of plumbing that makes all of this work or not work in some cases that California has put in place. So you get past Mendota Pool and the next sort of, you know, big structure on the river, and it's not actually that large, it's called Sac Dam. And it was named because it used to be just, you know, sacks of sand that farmers piled up to divert the river. But essentially, you know, from that point on, there is, you know, a, quote, diversion where all of the water that was in the river goes down a canal, and the riverbed is more or less dry. It sort of leaks past the dam because the dam is very old and it has wood boards. There is some water past that point, but about a half mile down the road I walked, and it dries up fairly quickly. And, you know, once it ends, it was a very, like, sort of eerie and sobering place to be. You see, you know, this blue water just sort of stop, and it, you know, becomes just like beach sand. And, you know, and that goes on for miles and miles and miles. I was sort of, you know, hoofing it through, you know, like sort of deep beachy type sand. I don't know. It's a sad thing. And I hope it's something that people here, you know, realize, and people across the country do too. I think our rivers are disappearing without much alarm. And I find it shocking as an outsider that this is a river that doesn't connect to the ocean. I mean, it seems one of the basic concepts of the water cycle and, you know, how the natural environment works, that rivers would connect to the sea. And so I came into this again thinking, you know, that this was a huge problem. I've met people along the way that have complicated my view. You know, I've met farm owners and farm workers who say, look, the river is healthy up by Fresno. It's healthy where people could use it if they wanted to. And, you know, who cares if down here it's nothing but a ditch. You know, we need that water to grow food. One farmer actually kayaked with me for a day, and he told me that, you know, we're floating on food. Like, you know, instead of water, he sees that water as food, as a commodity, as a crop. And, you know, obviously that powers this region. So as I've gone down, it's only gotten more and more complicated. But what I can say is that I think all of us need to turn our eyes to the rivers. I think we, you know, cross over them on highways and don't give them a second thought. We don't travel by river anymore, you know, the way we once did. And I think that is part of the reason why they've become so damaged and altered, because people don't even notice.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with John D. Sutter. He is a columnist for CNN Opinion and the creator of CNN's Change the List project. His latest adventure as part of that effort is to navigate the waters, or lack of water, in the San Joaquin River from the base of Fryant Dam all the way to San Francisco Bay. He is currently in Merced County in an area that is by and large dry. Walk me through how you're doing this. Are you dragging your canoe? Do you have a trailer? Do you have a support team? How is this working for you as a experiential journalist out there?
So right now I'm like sitting in the middle of some cattails on the side of the river, trying to get some shade and to stay out of the wind. But I've, you know, been dragging my boat sort of through the drier sections of the river today. I started it at Highway 165. I'm by myself right now. I've had a number of people joining me, and some of them, like, just, you know, found out about the project, thought it was interesting, care about this river deeply, and wanted to join me for a day or several. There's a group called Rivers for Change, and some volunteers from that group have joined me for longer than any other group. They're out ahead of me a little bit right now, you know, doing some of the river on their own. So it's been a mix of, you know, some people who have helped me with, you know, sort of shuttling boats around. But right now I'm sort of, you know, trying to go out on the river solo for a bit and, you know, just me and the boat. And I have, you know, like a tent and food and water and all this stuff packed in it. You know, the logistics of it, like, in some ways it's aside to, you know, the real story that is the people, you know, in California who really do depend on this river. But it has been illuminating for me to just try to do this. Like, when I talked to the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, I asked them, you know, can I use a backpacker's pump and filter the water from the river and drink it, or do I need to carry water with me? And they said, one, no one had ever asked them that before, which I thought was telling, and two, that past Mendota Pool, that the river is too polluted with agricultural runoff to even filter or treat chemically and then drink. So I'm having to carry, you know, large amounts of water, which is probably the heaviest thing I have in my boat right now, you know, to make this work. I just, you know, 30 minutes ago, I saw a state park ranger who was standing up on a bluff And he sort of called down like, hey, what are you doing down there? Like, not anything bad. He was just checking to make sure I was okay. But I think the people I've encountered are always surprised that there's someone on the San Joaquin River at all, like, you know, much less trying to, you know, connect it to the sea, because it's just something that, you know, that almost isn't possible.
Have you had anyone say, are you crazy?
Oh my gosh, I've had almost everyone say, are you crazy? I think a lot of the Central Valley thinks I'm crazy. But I've had a lot of people say that they think that's a really neat idea too, and they ask me questions about it. Like when I pulled into Skaggs Bridge over, you know, last weekend, a week ago, in a kayak, I had kids running up asking, you know, what is this? Like, how does it work? Like, where's your, you know, paddle? I had a solar panel on the front to charge my phone, and, you know, they're asking me how that worked. And I sort of spent a little time there talking to them. I think that there is a real interest and curiosity about, you know, the state's water and our country's water, where it comes from, where it goes. And that's, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to highlight.
This is part of a project which I mentioned, Change the List, that you've been working on for some time now at CNN. What's the rationale there, and what do you hope to accomplish with your work? Is there going to be some big piece that comes to this? What do you hope to accomplish?
Yeah, so with Change the List, I basically try to shed light on bottom-of-the-list places and sort of root for them. I see these as underdog stories. The San Joaquin was ranked by, you know, American Rivers, as you said, as the most endangered river in the country. I've done other projects on the county in the U.S. with the highest level of income inequality, or the mammal that's the most illegally trafficked in the world. So these topics vary. Our readers actually, FCNN.com, vote on these issues. So they voted for a story on rivers, which I thought was pretty awesome. And then, you know, I find the bottom of the list place, so to speak, and then go there and try to advocate on its behalf. And I'm still in the middle of this journey, so I'm still trying to figure out what that means exactly and what the solutions are. I ask, you know, almost everyone I meet, like, what do you think can and should be done here? I get a range of answers, and often I get sort of a just sense of dismay, you know, that this river is so far gone. You know, can we save it? Should we save it? How much will that cost? Those are some of the questions I've heard, especially out in the agricultural areas. But my goal with the project is to try to bring a sense of hope, to bring a national audience to some overlooked places and overlooked issues. And so, you know, my hope is that this can be a positive thing for the Valley. It can get people talking and maybe bring some support or at least attention to the river.
You mentioned about saving this river, about turning it around. Do you hear any consensus about what that would even mean?
Yeah, I don't think there is a consensus. I think there's a lot of disagreement, but I do think that there is quite a bit of common ground. Like one thing I've been asking people about is whether they care about connecting the river to the sea again. And I had, you know, I talked to one guy from an irrigation district who told me, you know, he considers that to be this kind of like mystical blue line theory, and that it's nice as like a thought or as a philosophy, that rivers should connect to the ocean, but that, you know, that in this day and age with such water shortages and with climate change, that it's just not possible anymore. So, you know, I've heard that, version. I've heard people, but really from a range of backgrounds also, like including agriculture, including environmentalists, including just people I've met who say that they do want to see this river revive. They do want salmon populations back. And bottom line, you know, they want it to be a living river that connects, you know, to the ocean. So I've gotten a range of views. I think that there are some people who really have their heels dug in on this issue, but I think that there are many more people who aren't necessarily advocates, but are affected by what's happening on the river in many ways, who do share like a common passion, you know, for this water, for this system, and really depend on it in a life and death kind of way. I mean, this water matters not just for industry, but like I said, I mean, for like spiritual purposes. I saw someone being baptized in it, you know, like it just matters to a lot of people in a lot of ways. And so I think I'm out here searching for common ground, because I do think that does exist, and I hope that is what emerges from this talk of restoration. But right now, yeah, I do hear a lot of friction and not as much consensus.
So what's next for you in your journey?
So from here, I'm hoping water magically reappears in the river. Like I said, I saw the state park ranger who's standing up on the bluff, and I asked him what's up ahead. And he said, well, looks like more of this for as far as I can see. So I guess I'm going to be dragging the boat for a while. But, you know, eventually the salt slough comes into the river, which doesn't sound too pleasant, but at least will be water. Then the Merced River, you know, joins back in. And I think from then on, I should have, you know, hopefully steadily flowing waters. I'm hoping to make it to San Francisco by July 4th and to pull in there on kind of this, you know, magic, you know, American holiday. We'll see. I've been on schedule so far. It's been really tough in a lot of ways. I'm not a kayaker. You know, I'm not an expert at any of this. I'm just a guy who's interested in this river and trying to learn as much about it as he can. So, you know, I invite people to follow along if for no other reason to see if I make it or see if I keel over out here somewhere.
Well, we certainly don't want to see that happen. Be safe out there, John. Our guest today has been John D. Sutter. He is a columnist for CNN Opinion and the creator of CNN's Change the List project. He is currently on a quest that takes him from the base of Fryant Dam, where he started on June 14th, and where he will hopefully wind up in San Francisco Bay on July 4th. He's currently in Merced County on a dry section of the river. You can follow John's work on Twitter at J.D. Sutter, and also on Facebook and on CNN's website. John D. Sutter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You want to stay close by, because when we come back in just a moment here on Valley Edition, we'll find out why the Central Valley could be the next hotspot for computer programmers. That's the goal, at least, of an event called the 59 Days of Code, which hosts its big competition this weekend. We'll have that and political junkie Ken Rudin coming up later this hour here on Valley Edition.
Valley Public Radio's Restaurant Takeover Tour is headed to Madera. Join us Thursday night, June 26th, at the Vineyard Restaurant just off Highway 99. Enjoy a delicious full-course dinner and dessert with friends, supporters, and staff of Valley Public Radio. Hi, I'm Vince DiCicco, and I'll be providing the evening's entertainment. The cost is $50 per person, tax and tip included. Tickets are available right now at kvpr.org. Proceeds benefit Valley Public Radio.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It's exactly 163 miles from downtown Fresno to Mountain View, the heart of Silicon Valley. But this weekend in Fresno, it's another story as high technology in the valley is showcased with an event called the 59 Days of Code. Joining us to tell us more about the event is Jake Soberall. He's the founder and CEO of Bitwise, which is helping to sponsor the event. Jake, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
59 Days of Code celebrates the work of local technology developers, software developers in the Valley. What exactly have they been doing since April 18th?
That's right. Well, not much sleeping. So in the last 59 days, they've been building from scratch market-ready web applications. So this could be the sorts of things that you use on your telephone or on the internet, but they have the functionality that does all of the really neat things that technology does to help make our lives easier, advance business purposes and those sorts of things. But best of all, they've been doing it right here in Fresno.
Do you find that people are surprised to learn that there are people developing apps and things like that here in the Valley?
Every single day, but fortunately, less and less so. I think that it's a sign of the progress that 59 Days of Code has made, that you still run into the folks that are surprised that there is a technology industry in Fresno, but you also have that set of people that are kind of anticipating, well, what's going to be next at this year's 59 Days of Code, and that's fun to see.
This is the fifth year of the event. How has it changed over the years? How has the local technology scene changed in that time? Maybe is the more important question.
Yeah, well, dramatically is the answer to that question. We have gone from a scenario in which we needed to prove that there was the talent in Fresno. We wanted to test the concept, and I wasn't involved at that time. But now you see today the technology industry in Fresno really booming. Companies moving from outside of Fresno to be in Fresno. Companies here that are homegrown growing to hundreds of employees. And I think that a portion of that boom, it owes credit to 59 Days of Code, because whether it was a company that came out of 59 Days of Code or a company that used 59 Days of Code to find talent or even in Fresno generally using 59 Days of Code to prove that there is technology prowess here in Fresno, it's played a big role in changing the landscape here in Fresno.
So are these established teams that have been working together, this one-off developer working at home or at the hashtag or where have you, that are trying to develop the software? Exactly how are these teams working to win the prize money?
Yeah, so all of the above. You've got students who are in high school who took a coding class at Geekwise Academy and are putting together an application. You've got professionals working for Inc. 500 companies here in Fresno that got together in after hours, said, let's build this thing and you know, try our own hand at launching it, building together, and everything in between. You've got designers working with developers, working with entrepreneurs, and you're seeing the fruits of a lot of labor come to head, and it's not just the developer anymore. It's really a diversity of expertises being brought to bear on launching web applications here in Fresno.
So the clock stopped for these developers who were working feverishly with their espresso-fueled coding sessions on June 16th. Now the showcase is happening June 28th. Is this when we find out the winner or the winners?
That's right. So for me, I look back to when I was a kid and my dad took me to the air show and you got to see all this awesome stuff. That's how I kind of feel about 59 Days of Code. And on Saturday will be the air show, if you will. First thing begins at noon on Saturday at the convention center. The doors will open and the general public for completely free will be able to walk through, play with these apps, get to know the founders, talk about what they've built, and that showcase is open from noon to 4 p.m. At 4 p.m., the showcase floor shuts down, and by then the judges will have selected three finalists in each category. The finalist will pitch from the stage, kind of Shark Tank-esque, and the judges will select a winner in each category that will walk away with not only the seed funding that 59 Days of Code gives each year, and the top category $10,000, but all sorts of software licenses and resources to go out and start their business.
Tell me about those pitches. What's that process like?
The pitch is really neat. What you're doing is, so now they know they've been selected as finalists, but they've only known that for about an hour. And now they're put up on the stage in front of normally about 300-400 people stick around for the awards, and they are pitching to win this money. It's just them or somebody else who's going to win it. There's not a lot of – by then the competition has been whittled down. They're selling their app as a viable business, and so they're pitching to the judges in the audience, the marketplace that it would occupy, the problem that it solves, and everything that relates to that. And it really, really is neat. You've got some folks that are extraordinarily polished and some folks that just choose to own their geekiness and talk about the technology. Both are very beneficial. Every part about it is entertaining and very fun.
This is the fifth year. What have some of the success stories been out of the past?
Yeah, so one of the really neat things is that 59 Days of Code each year has launched at least two businesses that are still in existence today. You have some that have reached really neat heights. One from a couple of years ago, Ventata, is a really neat example, a dynamic price-fixing tool. You have the Numa Group, where you had an experienced entrepreneur and developer, Rob Walling, hired a winner in Derek Reimer, and they together are teaming up and have done some really exciting things with that business. And then I owe a personal debt of gratitude to 59 Days of Code, never having been a competitor, but the founder of 59 Days of Code, Irma, and I met through 59 Days of Code, and that's how we launched Bitwise Industries. And so there have been both easy to see, you take an entry and it grow it into a business results that have launched businesses, and then that indirect result where you've got an attendee who is an entrepreneur who meets a developer at the event and they get together and launch something. And the economic impact of it, though, has just been mammoth.
Do you have any idea of the size of the local software development community?
It's tough to say. I know when we talk about companies, we're well into the hundreds. There are a lot of burgeoning companies. When you talk about individuals, if I was to guess at it, I think you're in the thousands, well into the thousands. It's hard to say because the number changes rapidly.
And you have a lot of people who are working freelance gigs and
that's right,
going from company to company or project to project, right?
That's exactly right. We our traditional metrics do a really bad job at telling us the story of the technology industry because there is a freedom that is kind of expected in that industry that's not normal to being a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant. Instead, you want to work for 50 companies doing 50 exciting things, and you can. And you don't want to work 9 to 5. We've got folks that they seem to work 3 p.m. till 3 a.m., and it's just a very different industry, it's fast-changing and dynamic. So it's difficult to measure with our usual figures.
You've talked about economic development, these new companies starting. Is this something that you think has more – there's more room left to grow in this area? Is this something that the region should look to as a new source of economic development and growth? Is there room for the Valley to grow in an area where we have Silicon Valley and Los Angeles has its own thriving tech community as well? Is there room in California for something unique to happen in this part of the state?
There's absolutely no question that there is room. Fresno has some very real economic characteristics that make it a very viable place for the growth of the technology industry. I mean, if we look in real terms at the biggest problem facing the technology industry is how we're going to find talent fast enough to keep up with demand. It isn't like another industry where we're all kind of fighting for survival and competing for the same business. There's more business than anyone knows what to do with. So what you see is the technology industry gravitates to talent. Talent dictates where the industry grows next. You've seen that happen recently in Austin and in Portland. Lots of available talent, and so the technology industry grows up. If we look today as things currently sit at the poles of the technology industry, let's take the Silicon Valley where there's a scarcity of software developers, meaning a developer can demand $200 an hour to get out of bed, and they do, and they make it. That's a very difficult landscape in which to start a new business. If we look at the other end of the pole, the spectrum, India, or there's plenty of available labor, but there is no living wage, which means that the highest and best of economic achievement looks like leaving that place and going to another. Those systems are breaking and will break. And so what you need, my soapbox, is a middle market in the United States where you can have this very precise dynamic be true. And that's a developer says $40,000 to $60,000 a year for the first part of my career is a really wonderful living. I can buy a house. I can have some kids. I can get married. I can drive a nice car. All of those things in that range in this place. Meanwhile, if you're a Google, if you're an Amazon, if you're one of our homegrown bigs like Decipher, that represents a 75% discount off of what you would pay for that same developer in the Silicon Valley. That is an economic advantage that exists in Fresno that we can exploit to create a very, very robust industry here, knowing that later on you get those higher level jobs that trickle in alongside of the volume opportunities. So, yes, there is a very real opportunity to grow our very own technology industry here in Fresno.
But with that high wage paid just a few hundred miles or less than 200 miles away, has it been difficult to retain some of those talented people? Is that a challenge that your industry faces? We've heard a lot about the brain drain. Does it apply to this industry as well, do you think?
It does. Unfortunately, it implies it's been decreasing. What we're seeing is that the growth of companies to reach have kind of a global reach, whether it be Decipher or Pelco or Decade or even, you know, a smaller example in payroll people, provides high-level opportunities here in Fresno. And then I do think that Bitwise Industries coming alongside and providing place has played a very real part in that. I love telling the story. There's a young man, hangs out down at Bitwise, and he works for a company there. He's been offered a job at Facebook, and he turned it down because he didn't want to leave working at Bitwise. That is not the norm. But you don't start with the norm. You start with the outlier, and then you begin to develop a snowball that makes a place something special and that can compete directly with the Silicon Valley. And that's where we're at right now.
Going back to 59 Days of Code, before we go, I want to close on this. I understand this is the fifth year. It's also the last year for this event. Why is that, and what's happening?
It is. The short answer, I guess, is that 59 Days of Code worked. When we set out, and I wasn't involved in the early group, but when the group set out at 59 Days of Code, the goal was to change things, to prove that we could have a technology industry, to prove that we had the talent, to prove that these sorts of things could happen in Fresno. It worked. They can. They're happening. And so the viewpoint of the 59 Days of Code Board of Directors is that once that happens, we can either continue doing it for its own sake, and there is intrinsic value in that, or you seed center stage and let the doers get in now and actually do. And so very, you know, Calvin and Hobbes-esque at our peak, we want to step out of the way and let all of these folks who have now flocked to this, you know, this central meeting place decide what's next. And I don't know what that is, but I think there's a lot of exciting things coming down the pipe. And so my hope is that people don't assume from the headline that, oh, my goodness, 59 Days of Code has failed. Quite the opposite. It did exactly what it was supposed to do.
Jake Soberall from the company Bitwise, also with the group 59 Days of Code. The event takes place Saturday, June 28th, at the Fresno Convention Center, showcasing the works of local software technology developers who've been working over the past couple of months to bring together their teams to develop new software applications in the local technology industry. Jake, if people want more information, where can they find it?
59daysofcode.com. So that's the number 59 and then the word daysofcode.com.
Jake Soberall of Bitwise, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Last week, Central California took center stage in Washington, D.C. when House Republicans elected Bakersfield's Kevin McCarthy as the next majority leader. He's the first Californian to hold that post, replacing Eric Cantor, who lost his seat in a primary upset. Joining us now to tell us more about the remarkable rise of Kevin McCarthy is a familiar voice to many Valley Public Radio listeners, political junkie Ken Rudin. Welcome to Valley Edition.
Thanks so much for having me. And yes, it is a very rapid rise for Kevin McCarthy.
He began his service in the House in 2006. Is this atypical to have someone ascend to the top of the leadership of his party in such a quick fashion, especially in a state that's not known as being a Republican stronghold?
Well, it's not unprecedented, but it certainly is unusual, given the fact that the new majority leader, Kevin McCarthy, was first elected to the House in 2006. Now his whip, Stephen Scalise of Louisiana, was first elected to the House in 2008. There's an impatience in Congress lately, especially among the Republicans, where once upon a time you had to be there for, like, you know, I mean, if you were elected in 1066, then you become the majority leader, something like that. But now it's a rapid rise. People don't stay that long. Unless you're Charlie Rangel, who's running for renomination today in New York, but for the most part, they're impatient, they're aggressive, and they want to move up fast. Not that Kevin McCarthy is that aggressive. I mean, what's fascinating about McCarthy? I mean, he was elected to the state assembly in 2002, and he was a minority leader in 2004. So, I mean, everybody who knows him, everybody who's watched him in action, have been impressed with him, have loved the fact his personality, his charm, his savvy, and he's just, you know, he's just a winning over kind of personality kind of guy.
If he lived in another state, one that had politics statewide that was more friendly to Republicans, do you think he would have other ambitions and that maybe majority leader wouldn't be the place that he's going? Your thoughts on that? Does part of this have to do with California?
You know, it's possible. The bench of the Republican Party in California is pretty dismal. Nobody thinks that Kashkari is going to come close to Jerry Brown in November. But once upon a time, you know, House members were thought to be looking at statewide runs. David Dreyer, the longtime chairman of the House Rules Committee, was always planning a Senate run. Pete McCloskey, of course, ran for the Senate. Bob Dornan ran for the Senate. So sometimes they run for statewide. As far as even higher office, presidential, well, you know, the last House guy who was elected president was James Garfield, and that was a couple of years ago in 1880. And then when you think of, like, people like Dick Gephardt and Jack Kemp and Mo Udall, you know, they all had presidential ambitions. But it's very difficult to run for president from a House district. But McCarthy, you know, as I said, good personality, very, very likable, and perhaps statewide office is not out of the cards in a state that just desperately needs some Republican stars.
What sort of a whip was McCarthy?
Well, you know, what's remarkable about it is when you think of whipping, it's almost impossible to whip this Republican conference into shape in some ways, because there's such a big chasm in the Republican Party between the Tea Party conservatives, most of whom who were elected in 2010, and the older so-called establishment veterans. And so what's remarkable about him is that he's not an ideologue, he's not a social conservative, and yet as whip he is seen as basically one of them. He's one of the rank and file. And so he is kind of a guy who is, you know, given the fierce battles between the John Boehners and the Raul Labradors of the House, the fact that Kevin McCarthy is so laid back and so seemingly unaggressive, the fact that both sides trust him is a lot to say, says a lot about Kevin McCarthy.
He's a protege of former House Ways and Means Chairman Bill Thomas, who famously got nearly $750 million for his home district to build new roads and freeways back in 2005 in the transportation bill. Earmarks are different now in Washington. They're not there. Should people in the Central Valley expect Kevin McCarthy to, quote, bring home the bacon, or is this a new era in Washington and in the Republican Party now?
Oh, the latter is absolutely true. It's a new era in the Republican Party. It's a new era in Washington. And Kevin McCarthy, unlike John Boehner, he said, look, our conference is tired of the earmarks, are tired of the, you know, once upon a time, people like Thad Cochran, the senator who's up for renomination in today's Mississippi primary, would talk about the reason I should get reelected is all the money I bring home to Mississippi. That's a dirty word for Republicans now, and Kevin McCarthy agrees with that. As far as Bill Thomas, yes, I know he was Bill Thomas was his mentor. And he learned under Bill Thomas, but Bill Thomas wasn't the nicest guy in the world, shall we say. I mean, he could be prickly with the press. He can be prickly with his colleagues, and that's the complete opposite of Kevin McCarthy. So it's interesting to learn from Bill Thomas, but not to learn Bill Thomas's mistakes.
The last time the Central Valley of California had a rising political star like this, it was around 25 years ago, and Valley Congressman Tony Coelho, a Democrat who was House Whip as well, eventually brought down by a scandal. Your thoughts on that? You covered that situation back in the 80s.
I did. I was with ABC News when Tony Coelho, his junk bond deal and the financial personal finance scandal brought him down. He resigned from Congress in May of 1989, just as the Speaker of the House, Jim Wright, was about to go down in flames. It was not a good time for Democrats. But there is a lot to do different. There is a lot of similarities between Tony Coelho and Kevin McCarthy. Also, it's interesting. I was just thinking, Coelho left Congress when he was 47, and Kevin McCarthy is only 49. But also, Coelho became whip. He became a Democratic whip only in his fourth term. Now, Kevin McCarthy became the majority leader in his fourth term, whip in his third term. So even Coelho took advantage of that rapid rise. But the difference between Coelho and McCarthy is, well, the similarities, I should say, is both were very involved in personal relationships. Tony Coelho made sure he knew every colleague, every district, the lines of the district, the wives' names or the spouses' names, the children's names, their birthdays. I mean, he was very attentive to members, as is Kevin McCarthy. The thing with Coelho, though, is that money was everything to Tony Coelho. And now I'm not saying that Kevin McCarthy is not a good fundraiser. He's an excellent fundraiser, and he does distribute the money. But Coelho believed that money was the be all to whatever whatever you want to say, call about it. It was money. The pursuit of campaign money was everything about him. So it was money that made Tony Coelho the whip, money that put him on the path, perhaps, to Speaker. He wanted to be Speaker. He said he wanted to be Speaker not long after he was first elected to the House in 1978. But, of course, it was money that brought him down as well.
A few months ago, if you talk to a lot of political observers, they were ready to write obituaries for the Tea Party. Then with Eric Cantor's defeat, it swung the other way. The Tea Party is back in force. Does McCarthy's ascent to majority leader, does that change anything with the fortunes of the Tea Party, with the way the wind is blowing, and today's races that are going on in states? You mentioned Mississippi and some of the other races. What are we seeing with the Tea Party and the Republican Party nationally?
Well, first, I think it's very lazy of the media, and everybody is part of this problem, and I don't know why they do it, but it seems like every week we have to have a scorecard about the Tea Party. They're up, they're down, they're sideways, they're inside out. It's just ridiculous. When they don't beat Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, they're down. When Eric Cantor gets beaten in Virginia, they're up. We keep just going through this schizophrenic reporting, and that's just, look, every district is different, every campaign is different. But having said that, it's just interesting to me that given the fact when Eric Cantor was defeated, and he was defeated because he wasn't conservative enough, and this guy was much more conservative than Speaker Boehner. I mean, much more conservative. But again, the Tea Party felt he wasn't conservative enough. Kevin McCarthy is not Eric Cantor regarding, as far as ideology. Matter of fact, some people don't even think he has an ideology. He's just somebody who just wants to get Republicans elected. Once upon a time, that was the idea of being a Republican official, getting fellow Republicans elected. It wasn't a purity, you know, a question of purity as it was now. In today's primaries, for example, you know, Thad Cochran, the long-time senator from Mississippi, could very well go down to defeat. And he's been around a long time, elected to the House in 72, the Senate in 78. So you could say, well, the Tea Party's candidate, Chris McDaniel, if they beat him, it's a great victory for the Tea Party. And that's probably true. But Thad Cochran is showed his age. He's not been a good campaigner. He's not been responsive to a lot of things. He, believe it or not, Mississippi has this election law that, you know, you're not registered by party. So Cochran is trying to recruit African Americans to vote in the Republican off, which is just so remarkable. But so, yes, you know, the headlines will be Thad Cochran loses and the Tea Party claims a big victory. But it, like everything else, it's more complicated than that.
Yes, indeed. If you just joined us today on Valley Edition, we're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin about the latest in politics, specifically the rise of Bakersfield's Kevin McCarthy, who was elected to the position of House Majority Leader last week in Washington. Of course, you can find Ken Rudin's podcast, The Political Junkie Podcast, online at krpoliticaljunkie.com and follow him on Twitter as well. I want to turn now to California state politics in Sacramento and talk about Jerry Brown. What's old is new again in the state capitol, is it not?
Well, you know, I mean, of course, I love the fact that he's the youngest governor in history, in recent history, in California history, and the oldest governor in recent history. And a line I've been saying lately, which I just enjoy so much, is, I mean, anybody who likes politics, as I do, loves sports, and I love sports as well. And, of course, we were all intrigued by the horse race, you know, the possible triple crown the other day with the Belmont Stakes, hoping that the horse would win, would become the triple crown winner. And I said, you know, the last time horse racing had a Triple Crown winner, the governor of California was Jerry Brown. I mean, obviously that's supposed to be a long, long time ago. And, of course, 1978 may be a long time ago, but he's also the governor in 2014. And what a remarkable story for Jerry Brown. I mean, once, you know, derided for many things, his presidential runs, the Governor Moonbeam, the sarcasm, the jokes about Linda Ronstadt, and here he is, basically doing the impossible that nobody ever expected to happen, that you have a balanced budget in California after years of horrific debt. And now Jerry Brown is fighting not only a nominal Republican challenger, Neil Kashkari, in November, but he's also battling the more progressive Democrats in his own state legislature because they want to spend it all, because we have all this money now. And he's saying, wait a second, we've gone through some really bad times. We need this rainy day fund. Don't forget what we went through. So who would have thunk that Jerry Brown would be the adult in the room? And yet Jerry Brown is proving to be the adult.
How do you think Brown's failed presidential runs maybe changed him as a politician?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and I think the same is similar of Ted Kennedy. When Ted Kennedy ran in 1980, of course, Jerry Brown also ran in 1980, but when Ted Kennedy challenged Jimmy Carter in 1980, he was seen as a playboy. He wasn't seen as a serious senator. When he lost the nomination to President Carter at the convention, when he realized he would never be president again, Kennedy became one of the great iconic senators in history, with, you know, focusing on his Senate career and issues that were dear to his heart. And Jerry Brown, too, I mean, you know, he's had a lot of paths, you know, since he ran for president in 76, only 2 years after he was elected governor. He ran again in 1980, and then he ran for the Senate in 1982 and didn't go anywhere. He lost to Pete Wilson, and then he was, mayor of Oakland, attorney general. But as governor, he seems to just realize that he, not so much about his legacy, although that could be part of it, but the fact is that there's a lot of things he sees that he desperately needs to get done. And, you know, he's not a unserious person. He's very serious about what he needs, he sees as the key issues in California, and he's just very focused on it. And it's just, you know, for somebody who's watched him for so long, as so many of you guys have done as well, it's just fascinating to see the two Jerry Browns here.
There was also his 1992 run and the 1992 Democratic Convention and his relationship with the Clintons. That is a very complex story. Has he almost pulled a page out of the Clinton book, though, with triangulating between the Republicans and the more progressive wing of his own party?
I think that's interesting. I mean, the President Clinton was derided by the progressive left when he was president, that he would just, do this triangulation. And, of course, you alluded to his complicated relationships with the Clintons. He basically attacked Hillary Clinton during a famous debate with Bill Clinton during the 1992 primaries. And Bill Clinton, with his famous finger wagging, went up to Jerry Brown and said, "How dare you bring my wife into this? You're not man enough." I mean, it was really not nice. It's interesting to see the role he has done as governor. And he's not the kind of guy, you have the scandals with the Democrats in the legislature, and you have the problems, this and that, and yet he doesn't seem to be rubbing anybody's face in it. He just says, "Look, I just have a job to do, and I intend to do it."
Speaking of the scandals in the state legislature, have you ever seen anything like Leland Yee, indicted on corruption and gun-running charges, still gets 300,000 votes for Secretary of State in the June primary in California?
And he beat our friend Dan.
Dan Schnur, yes.
I mean, this is remarkable. I mean, not only was he seems guilty of sin, not only was he arrested, not only all these amazing charges, but he finishes double digits in the race for Secretary of State. I mean, I don't know what that says about the voters. Who knows what it says about the voters? But that was one of the more eye-opening things in the California primary on June 3rd.
One last thing on Jerry Brown. He has refused. He's been a little bit coy. He's refused to absolutely rule out a run in 2016. Should we be entirely surprised that he refuses to do that, or is that just the politician in him talking?
I think it's kind of a silly question. He has no interest in running for president. He's not running for president. And, of course, remember, for the longest time, he wouldn't say if he was running for re-election or not. He waited until the filing deadline to say, "I'm running." We always know he was running for governor for a fourth term, a non-consecutive term. He knew he could, with all that money raised. But he's not running for president, and he's already said things like Hillary Clinton probably has it if she wants it, although there are a lot of questions about Hillary Clinton, which we can go into at some other time.
Yeah. Before we go, I want to talk about one of the really hot congressional races in this area, and that's California 21. It's David Valadao, Republican incumbent, versus Amanda Renteria, a newcomer to politics in terms of running for office, but former chief of staff for Debbie Stabenow, also worked for Senator Feinstein. She is generating a lot of money, a lot of fundraising from different groups, and what are your thoughts on that race?
Well, it's a district that, look, the Democrats have not had good headlines lately. Everything between the botched rollout of the Affordable Care Act to the Bergdahl swap to the Veterans Affairs. I mean, there's a lot of things in Democrat and the foreign policy. God knows what's going on there. Democrats are really running for cover in November. She is a good candidate. She's raised a ton of money. She has a good story, and the Democrats really want this district. This district only has a Republican registration of 31%, and it's like a 50% Latino district. So here you have a Latina running for election in a district that the Democrats think should be theirs. But Valadao's done everything right. I mean, he's one of the few Republicans who realizes that there are demographic changes in this country. He needs to the Latino support is crucial for Republicans. He supports immigration overhaul. He opposes cuts to food stamps. It's going to be a tough race. Valadao seems to be doing everything right, but Renteria could be a rising star if she wins. But again, if Valadao wins, it may say send a signal to his fellow Republicans about immigration.
Certainly an interesting discussion, and you can continue to follow Ken Rudin's Political Junkie online. His podcast is available at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Ken, it's great to hear your voice back on our air, and we hope it's not the last time. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
All right. That's all for today's Valley Edition. We'll see you again next week. Again, you can send us your thoughts and comments. Email us, talk@kvpr.org, or follow us on Twitter @KVPR and tweet us your thoughts as well. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the California Endowment,
Health happens here, where we live, learn, work, and play. Learn more at calendow.org.